You want to know the truth?
You can't handle the truth
about movies.
Every Thursday on Breakfast, Maggie is joined by Graham Tuckett at 9:15 to chat this week's film releases. Check in with the latest blockbusters, indie darlings, Oscar bait and guilty pleasures. It's the perfect companion to your movie watching experience. Stay informed before you settle into the snug surroundings of the cinema. Every Thursday at 9:15 a.m.
Proudly supported by Wellington's own Lighthouse Cinema.
You're listening to Radioactive FM and Graham Tuckett. Morning.
Hi, how are you?
There's the microphone over there. I'm good. Seasoned professional. Yelling at a piece of air with a microphone 2 feet off to the right-hand side.
You're lucky they're good. These road, they'll pick up your slack for you. So, let's begin. Last week we had some pretty epic films. This week, what would you like to start with? Fantastic Beasts 2 or Kusama?
No, let's start with Kusama, because okay. I mean, everyone who wants to see a Harry Potter film is going to go to Fantastic Beasts, and it doesn't matter what the guy on the radio says. Whereas Kusama, like, that's some interesting stuff.
Really interesting. Actually, I saw some of Kusama's work. The National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne bought her flower obsession piece, and that was displayed in 2017. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's got a whole lot of different flower fabric, whole series of found objects, and she's covered this whole room in tiny little red poppies and pink gerberas, and it is incredible.
She's such an interesting story, and the place that her practice has gone, especially in the last decade or two, I think, is amazing.
So this is a documentary piece, isn't it?
It's a documentary. Japanese artist Yayoi Kusama. She was born in 1929, so she was basically raised and came of age during the deprivations of World War II. She lived in a very, very isolated provincial city, very inland in Japan. So she wasn't directly, you know, affected by the war in that there weren't soldiers running down the streets and bombs going off. But she did grow up in that sort of ultra-nationalistic and post-war Japanese economy where the place was kind of reinventing itself kind of very much against what its instincts of the previous centuries have been. And she's, you know, she grew up in a very conflicted sort of time. She always didn't want to be an artist. She always was an artist. She was one of those people who just seized on a crayon or a piece of chalk when she was 3 years old and basically never put it down. She's just had a desire, but a compulsion to create art.
And she had that real struggle with her mother, didn't she, of not being approved?
Yeah, she said she learned how to paint and how to draw really, really fast, really quickly, because if her mother ever caught her making a painting, she'd grab it off her and screw it up and throw it in the fire. So she became this lightning-fast sketcher because she had to complete her pieces so she could hide them so that her mother wouldn't destroy them. Sometime she made a deal with her mother that she'd be allowed to go to art school if she also attended etiquette school. And, of course, she never went to etiquette school. She just went to art school, and her mother basically, I think, threw her out of the house when she found out. Sometime in her early 20s, she discovered the American artist Georgia O'Keeffe, who at the time was living in splendid isolation in Arizona or New Mexico, you know, being Georgia O'Keeffe. God, I love Georgia O'Keeffe's painting. And so did Yayoi Kusama. She wrote effectively a fangirl letter, and she enclosed a couple of watercolor sketches that she'd done. And Georgia O'Keeffe wrote back to her saying, I think she said the work is interesting, which is probably about as high a praise as you're ever going to get from someone as bluntly honest as Georgia O'Keeffe. And she said, if you really want to follow your dream, then you should just come to New York City and follow your dream. So at the age of about 26, 27 years old, like in the face of the bureaucracy, you know, the post-war bureaucracy of America and Japan, you know, two countries that only a decade before had been at world war with each other, she somehow managed to get her visa, get her passport, scrape together enough money to get on at the time a very, very early plane, and like an early international flight, and she got herself to New York City with like literally like $2 in her pocket. And no clear idea of how she was going to exist, except that she said, I'm going to conquer the New York art world.
Perhaps what's really, really fascinating about Kusama is that her exhibitions are not like any other artist. They use the whole room to exhibit one piece of work. So you walk into a space, an entirely white room. Her canvas is simply not big enough for her, so she has to encompass the whole space.
So she's never been a miniaturist, even like in her early days when she was still in her 20s and first arrived in New York. She was always working on a fairly large scale. And then she went out from painting purely on canvas to, she did a series, you know, it was the 60s, she did a whole bunch of happenings.
So potentially she's kind of around the same time as Warhol and all those.
She got to New York in 58. So by the time the 60s happened, and the 60s kind of kicked off in about 1963, like what we call the 60s, is late 62, early 63, and, you know, up until 68, 69. She was reasonably well established. Like, she had her own studio, she had her own practice, she had her own a little fan base. I think she had a dealer by then. Or she had relationships with dealers. She was relentless. She would just like door knock and door knock and door knock. All these white male cis dealers going, oh, Asian and woman, two negatives against you. We think of the New York art scene and maybe New York in the 1960s as being this very liberal, everything goes, everybody's equal sort of place. Absolute bullpucky. It was as white and male and crypto-fascist as any scene ever, you know? It's like the idea that this was some sort of liberal paradise. It was run by men for men, and women were there to provide what men wanted. And women's art was still not taken seriously in the 1960s. You have to wait another 20, 30 years before women actually start getting taken seriously as artists by the male established art scene internationally, but even in a liberal place like New York City.
Well, that's so potentially her story, isn't it? I mean, she's only really become famous in recent years.
Well, Yayo Kusama's story is that she's never fitted in, and she never tried to fit in. And that was always her great strength, was always, I will smash your doors down, but don't expect me to be polite when I get inside. And she did. She eventually got to a point where she was irresistible. Her work was so good, and she was so insistent about getting it seen and getting it shown and getting a dealer and getting, no, I won't be in a group exhibition. I want to be in a solo exhibition. Like, okay. Her first ever work was not exhibited in group. It was exhibited solo.
Were you expecting to really like this film?
I went in. Look, I always like artist biopics. I think any artist that anyone decides to make a documentary about, they've generally got a really interesting story. Anyone who's got the mind that it takes to be an artist, I think, has always got a good film in them, and a good filmmaker can always bring it out. And this woman, Heather Lins, the maker of this film, really has brought it out. She took 17 years to make this film, and for the first two or three years, she didn't actually have Yayoi Kusama's permission to do it. She just went, I need to make this film so badly, I'm going to just start making it.
So she did a Kusama on Kusama.
She did a Kusama on Kusama. She followed her around. She found out everything about her. She talked to the people that had known her in the 60s and 70s and started making her film without Yayoi Kusama ever explicitly saying, yeah, you can do it. And when she did finally get to Japan with a translator and get to shoot her interviews with Yayoi Kusama, her speaking no English and she speaking no Japanese, but through a translator, Heather Lins, who's the documentary maker with us, at the end of the first interview, she said, this is the best day of my life. And Yayo Kusama looked back at her and says, this is the best day of my life as well. It's like, imagine hearing that from your idol.
It's a far-fetched throw from Georgia O'Keeffe saying that your work's interesting.
Yeah, but that's Georgia O'Keeffe being true to her nature. Then the second quote is Yayo Kusama being true to her nature. Like, I think, I genuinely believe that Yayoi Kusama wakes up in the morning and goes, today will be the best day of my life, or possibly the worst, because she swings wildly. The film, Yayoi Kusama Infinity, it's beautiful to look at. It's pretty brief. It's like 80, 85 minutes long. It's incredibly well illustrated. It's a kind of like, it's a fairly traditional documentary. There's a few talking heads. The chronology is sort of this happened, and this happened, and this happened. It doesn't break any rules or do anything revolutionary as a piece of filmmaking, but as a document of an absolutely incredible and ongoing life, and as a gallery of some really, really beautiful painting and sculpture and installation, and sort of as a social history of America and the Western world from the 60s to the present day. Like, it's just a good film, you know? It's just like nobody with half a brain who goes to see that film will go, oh, I just wasted 80 minutes of my life. It's just a good film. I liked it immensely. And I walked in there knowing next to zero about her, and I walked out going, wow, I want to find out more about her and buy some prints.
And also a nice tidy length as well. You love a good tight-knit documentary.
Anyone who can wrap up anything in less than 90 minutes, you're getting a star just for that from me. I'm getting so sick of like 2.5 hours to tell 90 minutes worth of content. Which brings us directly to Fantastic Beasts of Middle.
to tying up your own loose ends. Okay.
Segwaying like a mofo.
So this, I believe that the first film came around out around 2016. Was that right?
Yeah, sounds right.
So it's been split into three different films.
I was hoping. One. I didn't even know that. I went in tonight thinking, okay, this is part two, thinking maybe that'll be it, and it's pretty obvious.
But there's part three.
There's part three, but looking up the gods of Wikipedia tell me, no, they're projecting a five-part series.
Oh, well, so they're really milking this series. Can you kind of give a background as to what we're talking about for those who don't know?
Okay, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I guess we're going to call this like the sequel franchise to the Harry Potter behemoth. Harry Potter eventually spun off into being seven movies, the last of which was seriously troubling the 2.5, 2.75 hour mark. I mean, if you like Harry Potter, you'd love the films because they're so long and so indulgent and so true to what's on the page and so well illustrated and so full of like all that Potter shit that you know, how could you not like it? But this is like another franchise. They're not based on books. These are simply screenplays that J.K. Rowling has written. J.K. Rowling is just obviously compelled to write. She's like, as Kusama is with a paintbrush, she is with a pen and a laptop. She just can't stop but writing every day, and she's still like deep in the Potterverse, and she's writing another story set in the 1920s. I think it's going to get up to about the 1940s, and it's not exactly a prequel to Harry Potter, but it's like stuff that happened decades before Harry Potter. Albus Dumbledore, the wizard who was the head of Hogwarts, is shown as a young man, as played by Jude Law.
So it's kind of his young life.
Some of this young life of a guy called Newt Scamander. He's kind of like the Dr. Doolittle of the Potterverse. He's this young wizard, gets on really, really, really well with animals, but not in a way that's going to trouble your G rating. He's friends with dragons, and he carries a suitcase around with him, and inside the suitcase is this whole menagerie of impossibly cute little computer-generated creatures that run around and do stuff and fly and fart and belch. And it's all cute. If you like Harry Potter, you're like, hey, look, there's a dragon and a cute thing, and there's a stuff, and there's things happening.
But yet the tone of cynicism arises.
Yeah, well, for 2.5 hours. He goes to New York.
They don't pay me enough to do this gig. 2.5 hours of sitting through this.
Hush your mouth. It was like a 8:15 last night. I walked into Lighthouse Cuba Street, walked out at 11 p.m. Well, getting on for like 10:45, and then
it's playing at the Lighthouse.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then had to go home. And by the time I finished writing like the 600 to 800 word review that I did, it was getting on for like 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm going, man, I really should be on double time for this, but I'm not. So grumpy and resentful. Look, if you love your Harry Potter films, then you don't need me to tell you to go and see it, because you will absolutely adore it. If you're not a Harry Potter fan, this could be the worst thing that ever happened to you in your entire life.
Can you run through the cast for me?
The cast is really interesting. There is Eddie Redmayne, is basically our hero. Jude Law plays a young Dumbledore. Ezra Miller, who is like my favourite young actor in the world. Have you ever seen We Need to Talk About Kevin?
I have.
He was Kevin.
I've read the book.
Oh, man.
Ooh, disturbing.
Yeah, disturbing. But he's definitely a star in the making. He's also the Flash in the new DC spin-off as well.
What are your opinions of Eddie Redmayne?
Oh, he's fantastic.
I really like him.
He reminds me of like David Tennant as Doctor Who, which was like the biggest man crush I've ever had in my life. And he's kind of like a David Tennant in Doctor Who. Mm. He's like cute, and he's kind of adorable, and he's kind of adorkable. But you get this idea that he's really, really, really brave as well, even though he looks like this bumbling little sort of British public schoolboy type figure. The most interesting piece of casting, of course, is the evil guy in it, Grindelwald, as in The Crimes of Grindelwald, is played by Johnny Depp. And surprise, surprise, even though everything I see Johnny Depp in these days, I go in prepared to hate Johnny Depp, he's really good in this, like just playing an out-and-out psychopathic villain who unaccountably seems to be sort of basing himself on David Bowie circa 1983. You know, everyone said when he was in Pirates of the Caribbean, he based the whole character, the appearance and demeanor was very much based on like late-era Keith Richards. This is very much, he's totally basing himself on like David Bowie serious Moonlight Tour. He's got the shock of white hair. He's got the mismatched eyes. One's blue, one's brown. If you close your eyes and just listen to him speak, you go, that is absolutely, you're doing a David Bowie impersonation. He's got that kind of gentrified South London thing going on. It's like, honestly, I was sitting there going, if you break into Let's Dance right now, I'm going to give this film 5 stars because nothing that interesting ever happens.
This is not Bohemian Rhapsody.
It's good wizards versus bad wizards. There's still like 3 more films of it to go. It's basically Harry Potter all over again, but set in the 1920s and 30s. If you like this stuff, go, but nothing's going to stop you going. You'll love it.
Fantastic. Hey, thank you so much for jumping on board this morning, Graham.
My pleasure.
So that is Fantastic Beasts 2 and Kusama both playing at the Lighthouse.
You want to know the truth?
You can't handle the truth!
About movies.
Every Thursday on Breakfast, Maggie is joined by Graham Tuckett at 9:15 to chat this week's film releases. Check in with the latest blockbusters, indie darlings, Oscar bait and guilty pleasures. It's the perfect companion to your movie watching experience. Stay informed before you settle into the snug surroundings of the cinema. Every Thursday at 9:15 a.m.
Proudly supported by Wellington's own Lighthouse Cinema.